Hello nerds, welcome to a bonus episode of Into the Wild, a mid-month treat for you, and this one's a doozy. Never said that word before. Never used the word doozy in a sentence. 34 years old and I've just got to the point where I've used the word doozy. Don't know what it means, let's not deep it. Well, I hope you're all well. Hope life is treating you all grand and you're enjoying the golden nuggets of spring. It's nice to be wearing shorts and a shirt and not be wrapped up to the nines, sheltering from the elements. It's quite nice. It's quite nice to be out here. I'm in a park near me in North London called Waterlow Park. Equidistance between Highgate and Archway. It's very nice. Everything's growing up in flower. Birds are about, goslings on the pond, it's all lovely. Anyway, over to this bonus episode. You won't hear from me long, I'm going to jump straight in. This one is probably a long time coming, talking to this person, to be honest, considering the podcast is 4 years old, or 4.5 years old. So this is a lovely chat. Riley, this way. Sorry, I'm also obviously with my beautiful, perfect dog called Riley, so we'll have to keep an eye on her this way. So this episode is with the lovely Isabella Tree from Nepa State, the famous Wild Insight in the UK, that is famous for going from a dairy farm with, you know, very little future ahead of it, as Isabella explained, to this incredible haven for not just wildlife, but for people to enjoy, to gain from, to work at, and to be proud of. As well, it's an incredible story, but the reason why we're picking this moment now to talk to Isabella, Riley, there's lots of barbecues going on and she is very, very tempted. But my girl hates people enough to not approach a barbecue. The reason why I picked this moment to speak to Isabella is because Nepa State have a new film coming out to tell their story called Wildin, which is out on June 14th in cinemas. All the details for the film can be found in the write-up of this episode. And you'll hear from Isabella now, giving you loads of details as well. But I saw the trailer online and I was just blown away, absolute goosebumps. I was like, oh fuck yes, that's a trailer. Like, it was just absolutely incredible. The shots look majestic, the narration is, I don't know the right word for it, almost so gentle. It just gives you that buzz of this is a beautiful story, and I'm super excited to see it. And I just wanted to talk to Isabella a bit more about Nep, a bit more about the film, and how she feels about all this happening. It's just absolutely incredible. So this is just a little chat with Isabella about the film, about Nep. I hope you enjoy. I certainly enjoyed having the conversation myself and look forward to finally visiting Nep and meeting Isabella myself in person. So yeah, enjoy, and I'll talk to you at the end. Isabella, it's lovely to have you here on Into the Wild. The first most important question is, how are you and how has your week started?
Very good. It has got off to a galloping start. It's a kind of Mondays are always completely crazy. But no, very good. And just so thrilled to hear nightingales back. We went on a lovely post-supper sort of wander last night and heard nightingales. So that set me up for the week.
Oh, are you going to believe it when I say I've never heard one?
You'll have to come to Nep and hear them.
I know, I really need to. Nep's been on my list for
ages. It's going to be another good year for them at Nep. We were standing in one spot and you could hear five competing with each other from different parts, you know, all around you. It's amazing.
Wow, I really must come and visit. I really must. So let's talk about that after. I've got to say, if you don't mind me saying this, is this your office you're sat in as I talk to you?
It is my office, and I'm always quite embarrassed when I'm on Zoom because private eye did a cartoon of it, which I've actually framed and put in the loo. of my office because it's so untidy, and they've just put underneath it Wilding.
No, but that's what I was going to say. I actually see an office like that and go, that's an office of someone that has a lot of important work to do. I'd rather that than a clean office.
Well, I wish I could be minimal and organized, but there is a lot going on.
Well, it's lovely to have you on the show. Next question, because we do have an international listener base on this podcast, so I guess it's important for you to quickly explain who you are and what you do.
Yes, I'm Isabella Tree. So I'm author of the book Wilding, which came out in 2018. And it really told the story of the estate that my husband and I own in West Sussex in southeast of England. It's a 3,500-acre estate that we inherited from his grandparents in about the 1980s. And we really set out when we took over to continue farming. It was a very intensive arable and dairy farm, already failing and not making big losses when we took over. But we tried for 17 years to make a go of it, to try and turn its fortunes around. But 17 years later, we were £1.5 million in debt, and we knew we had to do something really seriously different. So in 1999, my husband made the kind of big decision to give up farming on NEP. We're on really bad soil. This is the basis of our decision. We sit on 350 meters of clay, and it's an absolute pig to farm. Sometimes you can't get heavy machinery onto it for 6 months of the year in a wet winter. So he made this decision to stop farming, which was very controversial at the time, literally went against the grain of his own family and most of the people living around us. But he could see that the writing was on the wall for the estate. If we didn't do something radical, you know, it would sink us. And we decided to do something that would work with nature rather than battling against it all the time. And we were really excited by these ideas of rewilding that were just coming online, I suppose, in Europe. These ideas that using free-roaming animals, all the big herbivores, the megafauna that used to roam Europe, temperate zone Europe, could actually generate biodiversity again. It can bring back nature by just all the disturbances that these large animals do, the tarpan, the aurochs, creatures that we hunted to extinction, but also bison and beavers and wild boar and wild ponies, wild cattle. All of these animals can disturb the landscape in such a way by their rootling, their trampling, what they eat, how they browse, how they make bull pits and beaver dams. Everything they do is a really significant disturbance on the landscape that creates habitats for other life, that generates a kind of dynamism and complexity that really is rocket fuel for biodiversity. So we thought how exciting that would be if, could we do that? Could we introduce animals in this way, in this free roaming kind of self process led way on our land at NEP, and see if we could do something for nature, if we could bring back biodiversity, even just a little? How interesting would that be? So we literally took up all the internal fences. We smashed up the old Victorian drains that had been taking water off the land. We allowed the ditches to silt up. We let the water sit where it always wanted to sit. And then we just left the arable fields after their last harvests, allowed the thorny scrub to come in and the trees to start naturally self-regenerating, and then introduced these animals to kind of manage it for us. And we took a back seat and just let them get on with it. And here we are 25 years on, and we've gone from being one of the most depleted, chemical-soaked, biological deserts, I suppose, like most intensive farms are, to now being one of the most significant biodiversity hotspots for wildlife in the UK, with some of the rarest species that we have.
It's amazing. And you must find yourself, I mean, for obvious reasons, telling this story many, many times to people over in different mediums. But do you ever get the point where you sit 25 years later? How do you feel when you look back, rather than telling the journey of what that 25 years was? How do you feel in this present moment when you kind of look back on where you are now from that 25-year journey?
I think we quite often think about that, actually, you know, sitting and having a gin and tonic waiting for beavers to appear at twilight. And just think how different we'd be as people if we'd carried on farming. I mean, you know, it kind of beggars belief, because in those days when we were farming, we thought we were pretty good stewards of the land. You know, we were ignorant. We thought that we would, you know, we're not horrible people and we love nature. And ironically, I was a travel writer and used to travel the ends of the earth to see it, you know, to see wonderful wildlife. And we never once thought why we had to do that, why we didn't have nature in our own backyard. And it was all down to us, what we were doing to the land. And so I think if we hadn't had that economic crisis, our own personal crisis that made us change tack, we probably would be none the wiser now. And I think it's made us very different people. We are much more kind of, I don't know, I suppose we find it easier to take the rough with the smooth and to trust in nature and you know, to let go a lot more, to try. We're much less control freaks than we used to be as when we were farming. And there's a sort of psychological lessons, I guess, in the journey that we've been on. But it still amazes me. I mean, every day I look out and I try and remember what it looked like 25 years ago. And you're looking out onto a land that looks more now like the Serengeti or the Okavango. And you kind of think, my God, that was once wall-to-wall wheat or maize or, you know, and it's just impossible. It gets harder and harder to remember.
It sounds like such a magical feeling to be able to, and I guess the feeling we all kind of want to have deep down. Do you know what I mean? Like, especially us naturalists or us that work in this kind of sector, we all want to have that feeling of going, you know, in our own 25 years later, being able to look at the land around us and just see mass change. And I think your story at NET proves a wonderful point of we don't need that we need short-term planning and thinking, but we don't rely on that short-term. It's looking ahead at that far, you know, 25 years is a long time, you know, to look ahead and to see these big changes. And I think sometimes, I'm sure you agree, our legislation or our decision making is very quick and short term, where really I think you prove that actually we need to think quite far ahead in the future.
Yeah, I mean, you say it's long term, but 20, 25 years, but actually it's a blip, you know, really. And we were already seeing incredible changes 5 years in. Nightingales started coming back about 6 years in. Turtle doves, one of our most endangered species, and the bird that the RSPB thinks we're probably going to lose next from Britain, started finding us, you know, about 8 years into the project. You know, insects just came back like that. I mean, you know, 2 years in, you were having to cycle with, you know, wearing sunglasses because you kept getting, you know, insects slapping you in the eyeballs. So nature rebounds really, really quickly if you let it. And the fact that we haven't introduced any of these species, these nightingales or turtle doves, they've just found us. So how incredible is that? You know, it can happen really, really quickly. And I think that's the message of hope as much as anything, is that we can turn this thing on a sixpence if we want to.
When you say you have your gin and tonic moments when you're sat there enjoying it, what is that moment? What for you is like the pinnacle? Because I always ask people on this podcast, what's your favorite? What's your best? And it's just how my brain works, because I feel like everyone deep down has got a favorite child. So like, what for you at NEP is your favorite child?
Well, I mean, at the moment, I think it's the storks because, you know, having said we didn't introduce anything, there's two other creatures apart from the large herbivores that we've introduced, and that's beavers, which are probably the gin and tonic moment, but also the white storks, because they haven't been breeding here in Britain for 600 years. And the first wild storks in Britain bred here at NEP, thanks to our reintroduction project. Literally, just as we came out of that first lockdown. That for me is an amazing story of hope because when you hear those birds bill clattering, I mean, at the moment out there, it's stork central. We've got something like 30 different nests. There's birds bill clattering from the tops of oak trees. There's chicks. We've got a live webcam, a stork webcam. So do look at that. It's kind of balm for the soul. You can watch it. It's addictive viewing, night and day. And you can just watch these storks bringing up their four chicks. And realize that these birds haven't been in Britain for centuries and centuries. And we've missed that wonderful sound. We've missed that sight of them, you know, walking curiously through long grass, you know, darting at insects, and those beautiful eyes that look like they've been made up deliberately with eyeliner. You know, we relate to these animals some way. We've had a relationship with storks in Europe for thousands of years, since the Egyptians and the ancient Greeks. And we've been missing that in Britain. And when you see, you know, as we now have tens of thousands of people coming to see these storks and watching them thermaling in the sky above us, you know, you just think, my God, you know, we can get these amazing creatures back and have living landscapes again.
This question, I love that when you said, like, it's part, I think the storks are very much part of our, I don't know, I understand, it's hard for me, I struggle to put that kind of feeling into words or that kind of moment into words, but I know when you, sometimes when you see things, you're like, this is part of us, like, and I think though, whether it's sound, sight, or just the experience overall, I really like it when I hear people talk about wildlife in that way. And this next question might sound a bit odd to ask, but I was intrigued to kind of hear how you guys see it at NEP and how you work it. Like, whilst the animals are free to roam at NEP, how important is it to the management of NEP overall, or kind of the backstep management, that the larger fauna are utilized in some way? Do you think that's an important part of humans in wilding and rewilding as a kind of concept overall, for humans restoring and also connecting back to nature and wildlife? Do you think that has a key part in this kind of nature restoration?
I think it's really just a pragmatic approach. I mean, we'd rather not utilize the animals at all, to be honest. The fact we do cull the animals, the cattle and the pigs and the free roaming red deer and fallow deer that we have here. And if one day we get bison and we have wild free roaming water buffalo, which is another of my dreams, then, you know, we'll have to keep those, control those numbers too. But that's only because we don't have the predators, the wolf, the bear, the lynx, to control those numbers. And I think the way to look at it is that, you know, in rewilding, we're on a spectrum. You know, at the wildest end, you have Alaska, the Serengeti, the Okavango Delta, wherever, Yellowstone National Park, where humans don't need to intervene at all, really. You've got a complete ecosystem. I'm not saying we haven't influenced those ecosystems, because we have, but essentially they're functioning, they're dynamic. They've got the whole trophic cascade from apex predators to prey to everything else. And we don't need to do anything. We can sit back and let it just let it continue. But the smaller you get, and so obviously here at NEP, we're tiny compared to Yellowstone, and we don't have those apex predators. The one thing that we do is we manage the animals by being that keystone species, by being the apex predator. Because if you have too many of them, obviously they're going to start impacting the habitat that you're hoping they're going to create. And we sell meat off the project. You know, we now have our Wilding Kitchen restaurant, and we sell direct to the consumer. And it's probably the most ethical meat you can buy in my
Absolutely, book. Yeah.
But if we had connected landscapes and we had those apex predators out there again, like we do in Europe, then we would love it if we didn't have to control those animals and we could just get back to a natural system that self-regulated. But we're probably not going to be able to do that in fragmented and controlled Britain. Even if one day we do get wolves back, they'll probably be in Scotland or the borders or in big wild areas. Even though in Germany, you know, they have 400 packs of wolves now, I think, and a lot of them are in urban areas. So I think it's really a matter of being pragmatic and having to control those numbers. So I think we need to be honest about that. We need to be absolutely upfront about how these animals are killed, how we butcher them, how we respect them throughout the whole of their lives. And they've had the best lives they could possibly have. And they produce, because of that, the best meat that you can possibly eat. So they're actually good for us. They have healthy social lives, which again, I think is an animal rights issue. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to have breeding dynamic herds because that's what they're meant to be. And also they're good for the planet because they're actually, unlike intensive livestock units, systems, they're actually sequestering carbon because they're helping to restore the soil and generate this kind of above ground biomass of vegetation as well. They're important because they are charismatic species in themselves. So they do connect people to nature in a way. But we'd love it if they could be even wilder, one step wilder.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a key word you said there in this kind of, you know, species use, especially whether it's rewilding or just, you know, in any country, is that word respect as well. And I think it's having a really solid respect for not just the animal, the ecosystem, and that idea that, or that belief that, you know, you can take if you're giving back. You know, if you can't just take, is that kind of giving back to the ecosystem as you guys have done at NEP. And I think, like you said, in the way you're working, is probably the best way to kind of make sure everything stays as it is working. Like you said, replacing that predator, I guess. Yeah. So I've got to mention this, otherwise the email to you was absolutely pointless. You have a film coming out.
We do. We have a film coming out, a film of the book Wilding. And I'm sort of nervous and excited about it both at the same time, because I don't think I'm ever going to get used to my face, this huge face on a big screen pontificating about rewilding. And my toes will never uncurl seeing myself up there. But, you know, it has been the most amazing film to make, because Dave Allen, the director, is incredible. And he's a friend, but we went to him, actually, we approached him for advice, because we were getting so many people wanting to make a film about NEP, and none of them seemed right, because they didn't really get the story of nature. They weren't really excited about the power of nature to come back. And Dave has made these incredible films, Serengeti Rules and My Life as a Turkey, which is totally brilliant. And you know, we respected his judgment. So we asked him what he thought about these people who'd been approaching us. And he mulled it over for a bit. And he said, look, why don't I do it? And we thought, my God, if you did it, we would love it. It would not only be a fantastic film at the end, but we would have so much fun making it with him. So, it was pretty much the whole of lockdown, actually, that he and the Passion Planet team were here. And it was bizarre often. But great fun. And all I can say is that the wildlife photography is, even now I watch it for the 100th time, and it's breathtaking what they managed to film here. Incredible.
The trailer alone, and I don't know, I see a lot of trailers come out there, and they're all wonderful in their own way, and, you know, including our own that we released, but yours gave me actual goosebumps. There was that it kind of, I just sat there and was like, now that looks like a wildlife story. It kind of just like heightened every species it showed was just heightened, and the excitement over it. I just thought it was absolute. I was like, I need to see that film straight away. I was like, absolutely right, that's on the list. Like, even if I'd never heard of NEP or anything like that, and I've tried to be as non-biased as I can, I was like, I am seeing that film. It just looked fantastic. And I think the important thing for me, I saw it and I thought, that's going to talk to people that might not already be into nature, the environment, or even NEP, might have never heard of your site before. So I guess the next question is, what are you hoping viewers take away from the film Wilding when it comes out?
Well, you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, we wouldn't have done this, I think, because we're not, you know, both Charlie, my husband, and I are really not into kind of self-promotion. And I think, you know, especially films, but I think we just felt that there, you know, it's such a story of hope, and people respond so well to that. And I think we need a story of hope. You know, it's so easy to feel overwhelmed by the crisis that we're facing, this gigantic planetary crisis of, you know, climate meltdown and biodiversity loss, you know, the loss of nature and all the life support systems on which we depend. It is huge. And it's much easier, you know, you think, well, how can an individual make a difference? How can one patch of land make a difference? And one tends to just put your head in the sand and, you know, think, well, I can't cope with this. But when you see what's happened at NEP so quickly and so easily, so readily, and how nature has the answers to all these problems, then I think it's really encouraging. And that's what we found from people visiting NEP or reading the book, is that then it feels like you're empowered again. You know, you've lost that sense of impotence. You can actually, you're galvanized to do something in your own backyard. And you realize that actually, together we can make a difference. You know, we can all join up and make wildlife corridors. You know, my roof terrace or my window box can relate to my next door neighbor's garden, or to the trees in the street, or to persuading the council not to mow the grass verges. You know, we can mend this broken land together. And I hope that that's the message that the film will get across, that we can all play a part in this. And so I'm hoping it will reach an audience who haven't read the book or haven't been to NEP, but will be inspired to feel, you know, together we can turn the Titanic. And that is the solution, I think, to eco-anxiety itself, is in the doing. As soon as you plant a couple of plants that attract butterflies or night flying moths, you know, then suddenly you just feel there's something shifts inside you, you know, that you can open up to the possibilities of what you can do.
You're so right. You're so, and I think it's that power in it. It's not actually a lot. I think sometimes it's like you, that overwhelming feeling going, I cannot change the world. It's like, you can't, but you can supply some insects and birds with, you know, plant bird food or like, you know, pollinator food and stuff like that. And I just like, it, having that feeling when some forget-me-nots come back the following year, a bit bigger than they were the year before, just going, yes, I nailed it.
Exactly. And it's something that, you know, your heart responds to somehow. You respond in a deeper level to just the tiniest little change you've made. And that is just really soothing.
It really, really is. It's from vegetable growing to, you know, just plant growing. It's absolutely wonderful. Yeah. So the film is out on June 14th. I assume there's going to be a few screenings of that. And then is this in the cinema film?
Yes. So it's going to be in cinemas.
Exciting. So exciting.
I'm going to be at some of them doing Q&A. Dave Allen, perhaps with him, and some of them we're doing separately. So yes, there's a whole sort of schedule of events around it. So yeah.
It's very exciting. Well, to the listeners, all the details to the screenings will be in the write-up of this show. Isabella, thank you so much for coming on to Into the Wild just to tell us a bit about NEP and the film Wilden that's coming up. Pleasure to meet you, and I will get to NEP this year.
Let us know. We'd love to show you around.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
So there we go, nerds. That was Wilden with Isabella Tree, who's just the most wholesome person, and absolute pleasure to get the chance to talk to her for this bonus episode of Into the Wild. As I said at the beginning of the show, all the details, Riley, all the details for NEP's new film Wilden can be found in the write-up of this episode, and of course do follow them on social media to see more, see the trailer, see more about the film and more about NEP. And of course, if you don't follow us on social media, sort your lives out. You know what to do. Into the Wild, Twitter and Instagram. And as always, I know times are tight, but if you've got a few pennies, coins, quids, whatever, spare, and you're wondering what to do with them, you're not, but visit www.ko-fi.com/IntoTheWildPod. Anything you give there can give. Anything at all goes straight back into the show. And we super appreciate it. But until next time, nerds, look after yourselves. Continue to enjoy spring. Hug a tree. And I'll talk to you next time.